So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Oh, Todd Abel to reverse the Tombstone Piledriver. He nails it. We're going to have a new champion.
He crushes his head right into the canvas.
What is he doing? O'Connor should be going for the cover drive.
I don't know.
Oh, he wants to end up with the Rainmaker.
He hits him so hard. He almost goes completely upside down.
O'Connor has done it.
We have a new IWGP champion.
Kazuchika Okada evens this classic series at two wins apiece, but at what cost? A tremendous battle. I have followed professional wrestling since the age of six. I began my career in wrestling at the age of 16 as a broadcaster. Josh, you have been in rings around the world. We have just witnessed another incredible chapter in one of the best rivalries I have ever seen. Kazuchika Okada has done it, becomes the IWGP Heavyweight Champion for the second time as he pins Hiroshi Tanahashi.
Hello, friends, family, enemies. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you for another edition of Review Away. Wei is wearing his customary Review Away uniform.
Yes, I am.
Yes, your old hoodie.
Well,
get a new one.
Here's the thing.
You don't like it. Just tell me.
I do. I love it.
I've seen you wear it once.
Well, you haven't seen me often enough then.
Well, that's because you don't invite me to hang out.
I mean, I feel like I can't have two of the same.
Do you want the receipt?
No, I do not.
Another failed John Pollock gift. Only this one you don't have the heart to put on your wall of shame. Yeah. Wei has a wall in his office that is covered in shirts I have bought him over the years that he really appreciates but would never wear.
I thought I finally got something
he liked.
This is such an embarrassing conversation.
This sucks, Pollock.
No, I love it. I actually do.
Get me money. Let me buy my clothes.
Oh, this is such an embarrassing conversation.
It's okay, wait. Just be honest about it. It's okay. It's like ripping a Band-Aid off.
I
hate it.
I like it a lot. I like it a lot. I like it even better than this.
You like it so much you gave it away to your roommate.
I did not. No, I would never do that. I would never do that. But you
give clothes away.
What do you mean?
You were a very, very kind individual.
Oh, yeah, right.
Our mutual friend at Jiu-Jitsu.
Yes.
Devin needed a gi.
Yeah.
And Wei just gave him a gi.
Well, I mean, yeah, but...
He offered to buy it off of you, and you were like, no.
I'll give him my gi because, number one, I have like four gis. And this...
You have four gis?
Yeah.
I need to get a new one. Mine sucks.
Get a new one. Yeah, go to... I don't want to plug any companies, but I'll tell you where to go. And if you guys want to know, you can just message me. But
what's a good value for a gi? Am I looking at $100 or more? Because I paid $100 for this one.
You can honestly you're looking at usually at least $100. Sometimes you get them for that's pretty cheap. Like otherwise, you'll probably look. You're looking.
I bought it at a gym. I didn't buy it from a wholesale.
But I think you could, like most of my gis are $120 and below. But of course, the first gi that I bought, which I ended up giving away, was $300, and I totally got ripped off.
$300?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
And that was on a company discount from a friend of ours.
Oh, dear. Not much of a friend.
Well, no. She definitely gave me a deal, but it was just the markup originally was already so high.
Why was this such a more expensive gi?
Well, it was a brand name Atomic.
Oh, okay.
And it was also sold at a gym that I think often tends to. It wasn't sold at Open Mat. It was sold at another gym that I think tends to overmark their prices.
Oh, wow. Well,
gi talk.
Yes.
This is it.
The gi I use right now, I bought in 2007. And I've been doing no gi classes forever. I think I've done one gi class at Open Mat until this past weekend.
I can only imagine what people are thinking if they don't even know what a gi is.
It's a...
No, yeah, it's a pet, like a animal. Geese,
yeah.
Geese. We're talking about geese.
Yes, exactly.
Canada geese. Yeah.
I pulled my gi out of my closet and there was like dust on it.
Yeah, sure.
That was quite the sign.
That happens.
I enjoy gi classes. Not as much as no gi, though. I just collar chokes and dealing with that stuff I hate. But I love
my favorite thing.
Choking people with their own collar.
Yeah.
Or your
sleeves.
Yeah.
Opens up more techniques.
Yeah. I think I completely believe that you're more disciplined and because detail is so much more important in gi than no gi. Would you agree?
Yeah, perhaps. I think it
teaches you good fundamentals.
That's what people say. Yeah, that's what people say.
I'm repeating what everyone says. I don't have enough experience.
I don't either. I'm
no, very, you're pretty good.
No, I'm very much a beginner.
Wei Ting is a very excellent teacher, by the way.
Am I?
He's taken me under his wing. After all these months, I've convinced him I'm serious about this stuff.
Well, recently at Open Mat, we have new curriculums now for every individual stripe. And John's about to get his second white belt stripe, and you're about to do a test for it.
Well, potentially get my second white belt stripe.
And we're provided with a very top secret list of moves that you'll be tested on.
Who's this top secret from?
Probably Open Mat is under Professor Sean Williams, who operates out of Five Star. In L.A.
So only the students can be aware of these testing measures.
Yeah, okay. out of respect for Professor Williams.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
So we're just drilling.
Do you have your own set that you're going to be tested on?
When I go for my purple belt, yeah.
That's your next?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's purple belt.
Test. Purple belt.
Yeah. That's not for a while, though.
It's not for a while, but I think you started like mid-2012, correct?
I started like 2 years, two years, maybe like five, 2.5 years.
Me being the date nut.
Yeah.
We did go for the first time together, you, me, and Ramdin, on August 18th of 2012.
That is weird.
The day of Ronda Rousey, Sarah Kaufman.
Oh, my God. Do you have a photographic memory?
No, I don't have a photographic memory.
It's just a memory for pay-per-view events. This is
no, it's not pay-per-view events. It's there's random events that I can remember. I don't want to talk about this. It's boring. We've talked about it way too many times.
I find it immensely fascinating, and I'm sure our audience does too. Like, well, how does anybody know dates this well? Like, do you remember? For instance, do you remember like the day that you met your wife for the first time? You remember the exact date?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember? The day that your younger siblings were... Do you remember birthdays really well?
Yes, I'm pretty good with birthdays.
I would imagine.
March 14th?
Yeah, that's right.
Yours is a rather easy one to remember for me. It's in close proximity. We celebrate pretty much the same birthday every year.
Yours is easy to remember too because...
it's close.
It was the day that the greatest rapper of all time died.
Oh, that's right. That's right, March the 9th.
Yes.
1998.
That's right, which was...
The rapper that died?
No, which was what day of the week?
March 9th of 1998 was a Monday.
Just wanted to test you.
Yep.
I'm assuming you're right.
Yeah. I remember, actually, that year, there was a girl I was interested in eighth grade. And I was going to, like, ask her out on a date on my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like, if she says no, this is going to be a crappy birthday. So I asked her out the next day.
Well, that's good. You're going to ask her out on your birthday or for your birthday?
No, on my birthday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. What did your dates consist of at that age?
Oh, at that age, it was pretty much just hanging out, like not even occasionally going to a movie. But a lot of it was just, I mean, Jesus, 14 years old in elementary school. It was very awkward because her and I would like talk on the phone for hours. And it was always very easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go to school the next day, and it's like we'd have nothing to talk about in person. It was just so awkward. And then we'd literally like go home, talk on the phone, and I'd be like making fun of it. I'm like, man, so we had nothing to say at all, and we just laugh about it. And then we'd go right back to the same deal at school the next day. It was so awkward in person to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. I think that still happens today with techs, you know, especially.
Oh, I'm sure it's compounded.
Especially, yeah, now where people only like get to know each other through the internet first and then they meet in person and it becomes weird. But I think that shows a high level of self-awareness for you to be able to even bring it up, you know, at that age.
Yeah, I guess.
And what ended up happening? So what do you mean? What do you mean hang out? You just like.
Yeah, we had our group of friends, so. She was not like allowed to pretty much go out and do stuff. So it was like,
seems
she,
like
it's very strict parents.
Seems like it's young to date too.
14. I don't know. A lot of my friends were like, that was around the age they would start dating and stuff. Yeah, that was about it. I mean, it wasn't very long. I think we dated like 6 months.
Okay.
Something like that.
Cool.
That was about it.
And what happened? How did it end?
She was – it was very very complicated story involving –
Let's hear it. We got plenty of time on this New Japan review.
Her parents were not too happy that she was dating anybody, and it became a very contentious issue, which eventually led to –
This bad boy.
Oh, my parents getting a phone call about this, and I was just – it was
what? What did the phone call consist of?
Are you aware – what your son is up to and what our daughter is up to. And they were like, yeah, we think it's great. Yeah, it's just funny. Funny to look back on.
Yeah, okay.
Teenage drama. Did you have any...
No, I'm a very late bloomer. Yeah. So that's why I asked, because like amongst my social circle, I don't think none of us really dated until like...
It was an awkward transition going from – because this was in my last year of elementary school and then going to high school where it was – this is an all-guys school. So it was very difficult at that point because I was very much – when you're around girls, it's very easy obviously to meet girls, to socialize with them, become friends, and then pursue. And then when you take that out of it, it was very difficult. We'd have like monthly dances where – it'd just be very awkward.
Weren't you guys like across like the street from like?
We were very close by to where the all girls school was, and I still maintained all like friendships from like elementary school of a lot of girls that went to that school. It was like the two local high schools that we went to.
What is the idea behind all same gendered schools?
I can't even tell you what the thought process was. I mean, obviously something very deep in, I guess. Historical tradition of somehow separating genders, but it was very bizarre to me. I didn't hate it though. It sounds like this, oh my God, an all guys Catholic school. I mean, it was a pretty laid back environment. I find guys are completely different when there aren't girls around. And I did spend a semester in high school going to a public school. I did one semester at a public high school, and I hated it. And I transferred back after one semester. I just really didn't like
it
at all.
All these girls, man.
It wasn't even that. It was just, first of all, I transferred halfway through the year, which was just death. Like, I just went there, and I was miserable. I'd left all my friends. I'm around here where I knew a handful of people. And I hated it. I would go home for lunch, and then I'd come back. I'd do my classes and just did not like it at all. Not like it was an outcast, but I didn't have friends there. It was just casual people that I would at least make conversation with, but no one I knew, no one I hung out with.
So it wasn't so much the genders, but just the fact that you were new to the school.
Yeah, it was just a different vibe. I mean, I don't really have anything against public schools if that's, works for people. But I think that guys are just typically in this all-guys environment. They're just like – it was much less trying to put on a show for people. It was just like – I don't know. It wasn't too bad at all. Mm. You just have to make the extra effort to cross the street, I guess.
Right.
Yes. But you went to a public high school.
Yes, I did.
Were you a big popular guy in your high school?
Not at all. I mean –
Did you join any sports or clubs?
Yes. I was part of this trivia club.
All right.
Are you familiar with the Reach for the Top?
I am.
Yeah, I was on that team, on our school's team. And one year, actually, we ended up making it onto there's a show on the CBC called Smart Ask.
Yeah.
And we actually made it on one year.
Wow.
So, yeah, we made it to like the semi.
Wonder if we could get into the CBC archives. Do you remember what day it was?
I do not remember what
day. Damn it.
I actually have a tape of my.
No.
Yeah.
You just opened the door.
Well, again, it's...
Is this on a VHS?
Probably never going to see the light of day.
Why? Why do you even open that? Why do you give give us the tease?
Well, I don't know. Just
do you answer a question on it?
Oh, of course I do. It was like a 3-person team.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who were your teammates?
What's his name? Kuhan and what's her name? I forget the girl's name.
Oh.
But everybody kind of had the thing that they're good at, and I was always the pop culture guy. So I answered a question about, like, the question was, from which province is the band Wide Mouth Mason from? And I, like, buzzed in, and my answer, I remember, was Saskatchewan.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, that was a lot of fun. Those are fun times.
I immediately just think of Gold Dust saying Saskatchewan.
Yeah, so I mean, I wouldn't really say I was really a popular kid, but I guess towards the end of my high school tenure, I became a bit more fun.
I was very much grade 9 and 10. I was just such a I didn't really hang out with a lot of people. I kind of just kept to myself. I rarely went out with my friends. And then it was like midway through high school that it changed, and I started just being...
You blossomed.
I went into high school with the idea that, you can't possibly have a social life and be good at school. And in grade 8, I had been... Or elementary school, my last few years, it was like I had a just complete different look. Like, I really didn't put any effort into school in elementary school. I didn't think any of it really mattered to me. I got in trouble quite a bit. And in high school, I just flipped like a switch, and just all I focused on was school, and I was very much a loner. Mm-hmm. And then grade 11, I made a much bigger effort to just not be such a loser.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I think I just started I had made friends at this point. I still knew. It's not like I didn't talk to people. I had my friends, but I didn't make that extra effort to go out with people.
Yeah.
We also really got hurt, I felt, in grade 9 because the whole first month we were on strike.
Yep.
So when we came back, part of that was that there was going to be no after school activities. There were no sports. There was nothing for a grade 9 student to jump onto to kind of make those connections and stuff. And
this is why kids join gangs.
I guess that could have been maybe your direction you went.
No.
Did you have the Wei Ting gang?
No, we had gangs at my school, but I was certainly never invited.
Straight out of Scarborough?
Yes. Very offensive.
I'm sorry.
I had a problem.
Did you see the Straight Out of Compton Red Band trailer?
No, I have not.
It looks decent.
I haven't seen it.
It starts off with Ice Cube and Dr. Dre driving in a car talking about the influence NWA had on everybody. And then it goes and then it cuts into the actual movie trailer.
Okay. That's cool.
So,
let's hear more about your high school.
What do you want to know?
I'm liking this.
I made a very good transition. I think halfway through I enjoyed high school for the most part. I really enjoyed Grade 12 and OAC. They were my favorite years because in grade 12, I got to do co-op, and that meant I came into school, I did 2 classes, and then I was done and got to go work at CIUT, where we've both worked, and I love that. I had the most fun during my co-op years.
So you knew you wanted to be in broadcasting even from that age?
Grade 11, that was 100%. I wanted to apply to Ryerson because that was the only program I knew that, A, I could go to that was close by and was a program I wanted to do. I didn't want to do any other...
When did you know you wanted to be in broadcasting and specifically, like a host?
Oh, I didn't... All I knew in grade 11 was I wanted to somehow work in the industry. I had no illusions of doing anything on air. I thought I would end up being something in, whether it be marketing or programming or just I wanted to have some involvement. I just didn't know what.
You're a big TV fan.
Yeah. I didn't really have any belief that I would be an on-air person in any capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say grade 11 was when I really focused on that's where I wanted to go. And I think that was helpful because it helped me choose my course as well for grade 12 and OAC. I knew where my weak points were that were going to drag my average down.
Yep.
Same and here. Math science out the window.
Oh, me too. Yeah, I was so thankful for
that. I nearly failed grade 12 math. I passed with a 50.
I think I actually might have failed. I definitely failed calculus.
I think I technically did fail, and they bumped me up to a 50 because my teacher told me before after the exam, said, are you going to be pursuing math in OAC? I said, no. I was like, okay, then. If you tell me that, you'll be fine.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah. It was like, I struggled like hell in grade 12 math. It was the worst course I ever dealt with. Terrible.
Yeah, I did really well in like grade 9 and grade 10 math. Like I won like the top of the class award for grade 9. But then like something
I happened. Had an A in grade 9 math. Right. I had a B plus and everything else. I had straight A's in grade 9.
Yeah, but then something happened in grade 11 and my parents decided to fast track me, which is like basically, you know, in a semester at school, you could take the next year's course in your second semester.
Did you want to graduate early?
Not really, but I think it was just like, oh, okay, you're doing so well. Why not just, you know, advance sooner so that you can fit more math into your life? But I didn't like it, and I stopped working hard at it. And in the end, it all worked out because I didn't need it for radio and TV.
Did you have, in your last year of university, did you get sign-out privileges once you were 18? Did that exist at your school?
High school, you mean?
In high school, sorry, yeah.
No, not for us.
We got this when you turned 18 because we did 5 years. It meant if you were born in a certain part of the year, you turn 18 and you were allowed to sign yourself out where you'd have to go. It wouldn't get marked as – you would still get marked absent, but they would allow you to leave school. And I took gross advantage of this in OAC and – I would sign out, or I'd have I had a spare both semesters. It was the best in OAC because instead of cramming everything in the 4 years, you had five. And then I got a phone call 2 months out from graduation announcing that I had been late to class 35 times this semester.
Oh my!
And if you are late like three more times, you will not graduate. And I guess I didn't take that too seriously because I was late another 7 times that year and graduated just fine.
Yo, you're a bit of a badass in high school.
I don't know why. I didn't put more care into it, but I was just – it's because my first period was a spare and I would always show up like 4 minutes late.
That's the best.
Which I think you can sympathize with, Wei. You are not always a man on the clock.
Oh, I'm always late. Yeah, that was a problem with me. Like,
I always got there. I never missed anything.
Yeah.
I was a few minutes late.
Oh, you missed the anthem, you know. Yeah. So what? But I
sang every morning when I got up, just by my bed.
I got into trouble like all throughout my childhood for being late. Like my parents were called in a number of times because I was late for it was just an issue.
Did you ever get in trouble in school for like actual reasons? Like, did you ever do anything bad?
Yeah, I've gotten into fights and stuff.
Oh, you got into fights?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, like don't most boys?
Yeah, I got into a few.
Yeah.
The worst thing I ever did, and it was the guiltiest. Oh, I've told this story. The ice. I told this story, I think, once before.
The ice.
There was a patch of ice on the field. This was like grade 5 or 6. And all these kids are on the ice pretending to, ooh, we're skating. And I decided to just dive in head first across the ice. And I knocked over one of my good friends, actually. And it was a girl. And I came to school the next day. And she has a cast on her arm. And everyone announced. I remember all these girls, like, they shielded her away. And they're like, look what you did, John Pollock. Don't anybody talk to him. Like, picture the Bella twins, like, those characters. And that was what I was felt. And I think I might have cried that day in class. I sat with my desk. And no one talked to me all day long. I was asshole John Pollock.
Yeah, you deserved it. You broke a girl's arm.
I felt horrible about it. And then she finally came up. I apologized to her. And she's like, all right, it's okay. Do you want to sign my cast? And I signed it. I'm sorry, John Pollock.
Oh,
I still feel bad about that.
Oh, you had a very colorful life.
Oh, yeah, very colorful.
I think I would have hated you in elementary school.
I was a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
There was one, another winter story, and then I promise we'll get to our review. I was probably around the same age, and you know how you would always have, out in the hall, people would line up their winter boots so you wouldn't bring all the sludge and shit into the classroom. So I'm coming back from the bathroom or something, and I think there was someone behind me, and I was going to scare them. So I took a pair of winter boots and I tossed them from the stairwell over to, you know, you'd look over and there's the stairwell coming up. So I tossed them over and I just hear a woman's voice, and it's a teacher that I had just missed hitting with these winter boots. And I fucking sprinted in the other direction, ran into the classroom, sat down, just thinking, oh my God, did she see me? And a few minutes passed by. I'm like, whew, I narrowly escaped danger. And then the teacher walked into the classroom and just pointed at me. I was like, how the fuck did she see me?
Who else could it be but the kid who...
I don't know how she saw me, because I didn't peer over. She did not see me.
You probably had a reputation by then.
She caught me, and I definitely got detention, a minimum of a one or two. I was like, Christ. I just did a lot of shit to show off. I just was an attention whore in school. I would do anything to get a cheap laugh out of people, and usually I ended up getting punished for it.
And now you get paid for it.
Am I a show off now, really? I don't know about that.
I'd say so.
Well,
certain respects.
Sure.
With your knowledge, that's how you show off.
Yeah.
With how good you are.
From winter boots to my brain. What a transition we've made. Are you ready to chat about New Japan Pro Wrestling?
I think so.
You were very excited about this review. You've been talking for weeks about doing this.
I've been wanting to watch this for a long time, and I think we should, you know, offer some full disclosure. You know, we're both former colleagues of Mauro Ranallo, who's a commentator on the show. I was mainly excited to watch the commentary.
Yes.
You know?
You have the unique perspective of producing pretty much the same style of show for the Fight Network years ago when we ran Pro Wrestling NOAH, and it was Mauro and Dan Lavransky who provided commentary for them, and it was the same deal. They came in, it was old matches, and they do them out of a booth. And from your time working with Mauro at that point, kind of tell us just about the setup and kind of his preparation for it, how you guys put those shows together.
The setup was, I remember the first set of shows. Mauro, this was the first time I met him. It was probably within my first year of working at the Fight Network, and they knew I was a wrestling fan and also an editor, so they kind of put me as a sort of an associate producer on these. And Mauro,
you kind of just got assigned to anything wrestling. It was like, we need a new call screener. You.
Yeah. I mean, it helps that I was a fan too, but I wasn't the only one, you know. Like, we had a few people. So anyway, Mauro Ranallo at the time was living out from in Vancouver, in BC, and he comes in. This guy, we knew him from Pride. Originally, actually, he wasn't even the first choice. Like, I remember, like, when
did
we
do NOAH.
Yeah, we needed people to do NOAH, and I remember, like, some names that were batted around were like
Mike Tenay,
and
Gail
else?
Kim.
Tenay and Kim, really? Wow.
They were talking about I don't know if those two together, though, it would have made sense, because we did have a deal with TNA at the time.
So then, yeah, because you were a part of, you know, the finding Mauro Ranallo at all.
Yes, I was the one who suggested Mauro. And
how did you know that he not only called Pride, but also did professional wrestling?
Well, I knew him from Pride. I hadn't heard any of his Stampede stuff, but I had read about all of the wrestling he had done while he was with Stampede, and had interviewed him a few times for The Law. So right. I didn't know him too well. But when we were searching for a play-by-play guy, I mean, you kind of look at even the current landscape. I mean, there isn't a giant pool of wrestling play-by-play commentators out there, especially that can do Japanese pro wrestling and make it sound really effective.
Mm-hmm.
So when we brainstorm Mauro, it was like, yeah, why haven't we thought of this guy? And we brought him in, and I remember he was there like all of 2 hours, and he goes to check his email, and he just lets out his Mauro laugh. He's like, hey, Pollock, Dave Meltzer emailed me. He said, are you at Fight Network today? Man, this guy's good.
So anyway, just to continue that story. So our first set of tapings, this is the first time I met Mauro. Dan was there at a recording studio. We met with Mauro and Kevin Kelly, our producer at the time. And Mauro
not Kevin Kelly Ring of Honor, not Kevin Kelly the boxer.
The Fight Network. Where is he from?
He was at the NHL Network for a while.
Yeah, but he's from what town? A border town.
The Sioux
St. Marie, Kevin Kelly. Anyway, so Mauro comes in with his big book of wrestling moves printed out. BBOWM, Like that's actually for like longtime fans, you'll know
this. Big book of wrestling maneuvers.
Yeah, it's an actual resource on the internet that people had compiled over years of just a very extensive list of pro wrestling moves that I'm sure is kind of outdated now. There could be an updated version up there, but like Moro had printed the entire thing into this three ring binder, and on the front cover he wrote with a Sharpie, big BBOWM, and he just comes in with this, and like immediately I knew, you know, the show was in good hands, because this was at that time, like, I was a big wrestling fan, especially of Japanese wrestling, and I was also a nerd for like proper terminology of, you know, inverted versus reverse, and, you know, proper suplex names, and to know that this guy was like that, I thought we were great. And, you know, we were doing those first shows. Amongst those first tapings was the Kobashi Akiyama match from the Tokyo Dome of what,
2004,
which you can actually find on YouTube. I uploaded it, so just type in Kobashi Akiyama English commentary and that should come up. But anyway, this was like, this is not even the whole story, because the night prior, Kevin Kelly had taken Moro out, and they had quite the late evening of partying in the city, I'll say. So Moro comes in hungover, and just like the moment he starts calling these matches, it was just like everybody outside of the booth were just like looking at each other. Like, it's like it had, like we had heard Mariah Carey sing for the first time. it sounded like that. Like, he gets so crazy, and he's so completely, not ashamed of it. Like, not ashamed of causing a scene. I mean, in fact, it's his job. So
it's really hard to do that as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's just a startling image especially when you're not in the live setting, but in a closed, silent booth with only five people in the room, and one man is just losing his shit over watching this wrestling match. And from that moment, like, we just kind of knew, like, wow, this guy, like,
was that the first show you did? Good. Was yeah. Kobashi Akiyama?
That was part of the first set of tapings. So we probably did all six shows of that first run in like 2 days.
Yeah.
But then following that, Moro eventually got hired full time at the Fight Network, and then we received like just basically, you know, maybe two more years worth of Noah tapes, and we started to do them every single week. And I took the lead sort of in producing at that time, and they were very simple to produce shows, honestly. Like, I would just maybe do a little bit of research, I would cut the shows to fit time and do a little bit of research about storylines and certain moves, and I would just kind of leave it up to Moro and Dan, and they'd always be really easy shows to record, and I'm sure this was no different.
Yeah, they did all of these 13 episodes that they're in the midst of airing right now on Access TV, 13 episodes in 4 days. So you can imagine just watching, for instance, episode 3, where you have Okada and Tanahashi, and hitting that level and knowing that he had done however many episodes prior to that. I think that was the last one they did of that day. But you're talking about an incredible level of energy mm-hmm. to have to hit those amounts of times in a row. I mean, it's one thing to come in and you're doing a lot of commentary, but when you're hitting these peaks, it's rather incredible this is done in 13 hours and 4 days.
Yeah. I can barely talk in this tone of voice for an hour and a half. I can't imagine yelling and screaming.
So we will get into episode 1 was the Tokyo Dome show from 2013 with Tanahashi and Okada, and then we go into episode 2 and 3, which we're going to review today. And what I really liked about these episodes, that you already are going in with a primary focus on the in-ring and some of the world-class matches you've heard of over the past couple of years. But one of the things that any, at least North American viewer watching these episodes, I think has to come away with is the context that they add by just subtitling mm-hmm. sit-down interviews, the post-match promos that you always see on every big match show, mm-hmm. and the backstage stuff, and just simply subtitling it all. I think I enjoy that part the most on this, that it adds so much to where you're going coming out of this. It adds more depth to these characters mm-hmm. that you see in the ring, and then you actually put words to their promos that a lot of the time you're just kind of, you know, you can get a sense of what direction they're going in, the challenges that they're making. You can make out keywords, but yeah. I just love that.
Yeah, and with the format of the shows being sort of like a cherry picking of, you know, a year's worth of matches, you definitely have that challenge to put up with of, you know, how do you convey a year's worth of storylines into a select few matches. But I think they do a fantastic job by including those interviews. And I love the fact that they subtitled instead of dubbed the voices.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like you might see in many other places. I mean, you know, mainly it's probably a more cost-effective way to do things, you know, than to hire somebody to record voices over top. But also, I think just by simply doing it, it keeps the authenticity of the voices of the people speaking, and it adds a whole lot. The people who did the translations for these productions, I think, did a great job.
We started off with Okada basically setting up what March 23rd, 2013 was, the show at Korakuen Hall, and how we were going to get the finals of the New Japan Cup in the show. But first up, it was Shinsuke Nakamura, Tomohiro Ishii, and Jado taking on Minoru Suzuki, Taka Michinoku, and Lance Archer, essentially Chaos and Suzuki-gun, the two kind of warring factions at that point, having a six-man tag. And Moro would do a background of all the different venues that they were in, such as Korakuen Hall, probably in your top three of arenas that have hosted the most pro wrestling matches in history. I mean, you look at, you know, Arena Mexico, Sumo Hall, and Korakuen Hall are kind of your big three, I would say.
Yeah, and I think to have him and Josh Barnett there are really great people because Josh himself has had, you know, wrestled there a number of occasions, so for him to be able to lend some credibility, I think adds a lot.
Yeah, I didn't know how Josh Barnett was going to fit into it, but it seemed that they approached it with the right attitude, not trying to play any shtick. You have his UFC background, and you just played it up as a fighter that has competed with so many of these guys, adding his own expertise. And for the New Japan product, a much easier transition between mixed martial arts and pro wrestling. Like he's calling, you know, what is this Hammerlock or Kimura doing to you? And I think they found a really good balance between the two, where Moro could dictate the energy and Josh Barnett was there to add a lot of credibility and play that color role.
You definitely have somebody like unique in Josh Barnett who comes not only from mixed martial arts but from a pro wrestling background, who can find the right balance between realism and showmanship and knowing how to, you know, translate the credibility into a showmanship form of, you know, sports storytelling.
He even talks about knowing Nakamura since he was a young boy when he was working for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Ishii delivered a headbutt to Suzuki's head, which is a spot they use quite a lot, specifically Ishii and Shibata, just the head-on-head collision, which is rather difficult to watch at times. Nakamura goes for a gotch pile driver, but then there is a backstabber, and Ishii hits a lariat for a two count on Suzuki. Nakamura does a fireman's carry to Taka into a brainbuster by Ishii, and then Ishii follows up with a brainbuster to Taka as Suzuki is struggling to get back into the ring and held away, and Ishii pins Taka for the win. This match was originally 14 minutes. It was significantly edited down, and that's kind of what you're dealing with here in these one-hour formats.
I couldn't really tell. Could you tell the edit points?
There was one that was pretty glaring where you went from Lance Archer, I think, on the floor to cutting and all of a sudden they were in the ring. But outside of that, it was, you know, catching the highlights, which typically if you see New Japan or any of the Japanese promotions when they'd have their 30-minute shows, you'd have to do a lot of this cutting down.
I imagine a lot of this was just simply straight from the Japanese broadcast.
That's what I thought.
Which, you know, for Noah, we had that issue too, where they'd only fit such, you know, certain lengths of matches and would often throw in edits but on their own.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a fine six-man. It was kind of just getting you set for the big focal point of the show, which was the New Japan Cup Finals. Afterwards, there was an Ishii promo calling Suzuki weak and challenging Killer Elite Squad to a tag title match with Nakamura as his partner. Davey Boy Smith Jr. joined Archer in the ring. said he is sick of their verbal diarrhea, and in turn for giving them a tag title shot, Davey Boy Smith Jr. wants an IC title shot against Nakamura. It ends with them all accepting, and then we go backstage with Nakamura, who says he has nothing to worry about as long as Ishii is at his side and will teach Killer Elite Squad a lesson in wrestling.
In reading the subtitles for some of these promos, you can tell that, you know, these aren't direct translations. I mean, when you read things like, let's teach those good-for-nothing dummies a lesson. Like, there's no way that's a direct translation of the Japanese. But yet, I'm sure tonally it perfectly fits on with what he's actually saying. So you could tell whoever was writing these probably had a sense of humor. And these are just kind of entertaining to read on their own. And, you know, again, just I think the team here, just even from this first match, I really liked because, you know, Josh is great with his personal anecdotes, knowing a lot of these guys personally. And Moro, you know, despite being more well-known now in other sports, he still keeps very much up to date with professional wrestling. So he's able to relate a lot of these guys' backgrounds to current stars that North American fans would know, like a Daniel Bryan, mentioning Daniel Bryan's praise of Shinsuke Nakamura in a recent interview, for instance.
If there's one big negative to these Access TV cards that is kind of a constant throughout this, is that they want to give you all this context and they include these challenges back and forth afterwards. And there's a number of examples where they set up matches that they are not going to be showing you this season. And right. I think that's a real negative because it's like the whole goal is to make this as effective as possible. And if you accomplish that goal, you're not delivering with the match at the end of things. And we'll get into that more. But I think that's one of the big negatives of the show is that they – I love the idea of including these, but at the same time, if you're not going to be showing them, you're only dangling something that you have no intent to show.
I'd love to know, you know, like how much of the content they were just straight, you know, pretty much just like given right from Japan versus I'm sure there are a lot of numbers at play, like a lot of factors at play, like how much can they show time-wise, what matches they're actually given from TV Asahi in Japan. So...
Then we have Okada recapping the New Japan Cup, which is New Japan's annual tournament in March, where the winner then gets a IWGP title shot a few weeks later in April. Noted he had a tough match with Toru Yano, who's his Chaos teammate, stablemate, in the semifinals, which were earlier that same night, and said he raised the stakes of the tournament because of his involvement, and says that Goto is a tough opponent, and Goto's body avalanche is among the top three moves he doesn't want to take.
I love this. It's something that's
I want to see Okada's full rankings of moves he does not like to take.
Well, I love it because it just simply easily gives the audience a spot to anticipate during the match. And it's as simple as, you know, having the guy say, I really don't want to take that move. I'm very afraid of that move.
And that's something that I think could be so better utilized in particularly in the WWE, but
they don't focus on the in-ring aspects of a match at all in
and that's
promos.
A great storytelling tool. Like WWE always says we're about telling stories, but when it comes to the actual physical story, they shy away from that so many times. And especially with a guy like Brock Lesnar, there's much you could do with that.
I don't want to be hit with a German suplex again. You could just have...
Of course.
German,
you could... John, you know, John Cena simply, you know, giving a whole background about his neck surgery and what these German suplexes could do.
Absolutely.
One more could put him out and end his career. I mean, that adds so much more.
Instead, I feel like they always go the overly obvious route of taping up a shoulder, you know, and to like, that's at least something I'd be happy with. But often it's... That's about as creative as, you know, we get.
So Okada and Goto in the New Japan Cup Finals from 2013. As we mentioned, Okada beat Yano in the semifinals earlier that night. Goto beat Davey Boy Smith Jr. on the same show. Goto had won this tournament in 2009, 10, and 12. So going for his fourth tournament win, Okada looking for his first.
I thought it was a little difficult to explain the background of this New Japan Cup, especially in this sort of rushed format. You know, we're just kind of presented these matches on their own. And, you're pretty much just left with the announcers at the beginning of the entrances to explain, guys, by the way, this is the finals of this tournament that had just occurred. We didn't get to see any of the previous matches, but, you know, here are the finals. It's kind of it feels a little rushed and unclear when it's just briefly explained like this, but it's more so a problem with the format of the show.
To also put to light the Kazuchika Kazuchika debate.
What's the proper pronunciation?
Well, I understand it to be both are acceptable because when you are pronouncing the name in Japanese, it would be pronounced Kazuchika, but the English translation of it is referred to as Kazuchika. And that is always the way I have heard, and that both are acceptable.
But who determines the English pronunciation?
I think when you're trying to translate it, the Japanese to English, listen,
Why can't it be Okada or, you know, Royce Gracie?
There are people who think the R should be pronounced, that it's more just a Gracie thing about not pronouncing the R.
Right, okay. But we say hoist because that's how he says it, right? That's how the Brazilians say it, right?
That's how he says it.
Okay. So aren't we – so shouldn't we be going with what the Japanese say?
You know who I will defer to is Chris and WH,
okay,
who have taught English in Japan, and I always go with their pronunciations.
Sure. Okay. Let's ask them. Next edition of Japanese Audio Wrestling.
Yes, I think
please
we should
answer this.
Yeah, they should
I'm sure they have many times. However Chris says it is probably the way.
Yeah, that is the way I defer to.
Yeah.
WH has let me know in the past pronunciation mishaps.
Oh, good.
So, great. Good. Keeps me on
my toes. Put it in the fact-checking thread, guys.
Yes, pronunciation thread. That's what we need. That should be a whole podcast of Chris and WH just reading every person's name.
Sure.
And every version of the pronunciation.
See, like... what I'm more curious about is like how a Japanese person would pronounce our names, like well, John Pollock.
How we all call. Listen, your actual name, is Y.
Wei is how you would pronounce it.
But everyone says Wei.
Yeah,
is either
that's
incorrect.
That's how I say it.
That's how you say it.
That's how I prefer it.
So I think sometimes people get really. Annoyed at stuff like that, and sometimes it's not so much the pronunciation that is being misrepresented. Sometimes it's the way people enunciate certain words, and that's where you get kind of the lost in translation.
It really is impossible to perfectly translate every single word. I think it's a lot to ask for. So I would hope that there are certain...
like you go back to the subtitles about it. It's never going to be sometimes. An exact representation of the words coming out of his
mouth. Nor should it be. A direct translation, like a Google direct Google translation of Nakamura's promo would be gibberish. But anyway, somebody give us a clear answer. I'm sure, you know, Moro did his proper research here and you know, he pronounces it Kazuchika. I'm sure there's a, you know, you'll hear different from other people too.
Let's see how... howtopronounce.com.
Okay.
What it gives us. It's four examples.
Okay, play it. Kazuchika.
Oh, did you hear that?
One more time.
Kazuchika.
Next one.
Kazuchika.
Kazuchika. Kazuchika. Uh-oh. So wait a second. What was that?
Three of the four. And as I'm saying, I don't think either are incorrect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably right. Well, how does he say it?
How does who say it?
I can't even say his name without being
Okada?
Self-conscious now. Yeah, how does Okada?
Listen, all I'm going to say is I don't care how people pronounce it. I think either is fine.
Just call him Kaz.
Why? Review Hawaii.
You totally butchered it.
That's it. Didn't I hit it?
Polak. Yeah, sure, John Polak.
No, that's never how it's been pronounced at all. That's just...
Well, it depends who you ask.
Kazuchika, Okada, and Hiroki Goto, and the new Jakep. No, okay, let's stop it. Let's get into this.
It'd be Goto, like a website.
early on in this match, I enjoyed this. Moro noted that, I believe it was Goto, going for the cross arm breaker or the arm bar for you MMA elite. What a fuck you right there to all those Twitter followers out there. For you MMA elite. Moro ain't taking shit.
Oh, shit.
I love it.
Yeah, for all you people that are going to talk shit about me here, eat this.
I really like this as well. They explained not only the New Japan Cup, but different holds, their background, the lineage of some of these holds, establishes the differences here with the 20 count in New Japan, which I think is a far superior, just for dramatic effect, doing the 20 counts. Yeah. I think people get way more into them when you get to 17, 18.
Well, when you're doing a 20 count, you're doing it at a much more consistent rate than, I'd say, the North American 10 count, which can usually take up to 30 seconds to actually get to 10.
Last year at the G1, they did one count out finish, and the result was every single count out tease, people thought, it's like, maybe we'll see a count out. Mm. It only took one time.
That's cool.
I think it's great.
I mean, all of these things are there for a reason, and often it's there for intended dramatic effect. But I think, you know, because so many years have passed, we probably forget how to use those.
Yeah, there's so much to this match. I'm not going to get into everything here, but it really picked up, as do most Okada matches, where it goes to that next gear is when he initially calls for the Rainmaker, and we get the big zoom out. This is great. It tells the crowd that we're going into a big sequence at this point. He hits the heavy rain, which is a high fireman's carry, and then Goto blocks the tombstone. Goto comes off the ropes, just kills him with a lariat. Both men are down selling. Crowd very much into this. Okada catches his high drop kick to Goto coming off the ropes. Goes for the red ink, but Goto makes it to the rope to avoid it being applied. Then he hits the Shoryu Kakai, a modified seated armbar that Goto hits into his wrist clutch Olympic slam, hits the Ushikoroshi, and then Seto caught on the top rope, headbutts him, hits the Ushikoroshi off the top for a near fall. Then he hits the Ura Shoten for another near fall, as the crowd just popping here for all of Goto's offense, I think believing that Goto was going to win this tournament again. The Shoten is then blocked with an inside cradle by Okada for a two count. Okada goes for the white noise into a neck breaker, which is like a back-to-belly reverse pile driver. And then there's the Goto Shiki, which is a cross-legged cradle for a two count Okada. And the finish sees Goto with these headbutts to Okada to stop the Rainmaker. Okada then blocks the Shoten, drop kicks him to the back of the head, tombstone, and then lifts him up to hit the Rainmaker for the win.
And you mentioned how, you know, often in this match, but in all wrestling matches, you know, for the finishing sequence, wrestlers and the energy of the match tend to kick it into that next gear. And I think something that you immediately notice about Moro calling these matches is that he's somebody who is very...
follows that.
Not just aware of it, but is able to perfectly, with the pace of his voice and the energy of his voice, follow that exact pace. I mean, in MMA, he's able to do it too. In boxing, he's able to do it. But because in wrestling, it's so structured, he knows.
You know that the goal is to build a match.
Yeah.
Whereas MMA boxing, you can't control that.
No. I mean, you can tell when a match, if a match is about to finish, the crowd gets crazy. But because wrestling is far much more structured than that, Moro is able to pace himself much more. And I think he's honestly, like, of the three sports, I personally like him calling wrestling the most, because it seems to use his abilities to their full effect. And again, most of my commentary is going to be about the commentary.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was mainly watching for. I think Barnett himself is just very good too, because, you know, he's not...
I don't know if he had even done pro wrestling commentary before
this. He's done Pancras commentary.
Pancras, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he has. But I think he's great here because... You know, he's able to – the goal with these matches is to try to make them sound as real and credible as possible. And I think often in pro wrestling commentary, you get a lot of overacting with reactions. You know, on Raw, for instance. You know, you get Booker T and JBL just poorly acting – Like acting, it's a very difficult job calling commentary. But Josh and Moro here basically call it like an MMA match. It never feels overacted. I mean, they're just basically treating it like it's a real competition, and they do a good job of that.
Yeah, and I think they approached it the right way. And I kind of talked to Moro before they did any of these voiceovers, and just kind of the idea of how you're going to go in and call matches that have happened in the past, and you know, just the context of which you put these in. And I think they had a really good grasp on how best to call this. And I think the direction that was going to be the easiest for Barnett and that suited this was exactly call it as if it's legitimate.
I'll say, you know, compared to the match that we'd see later, there were certainly moments in this particular match that you could tell where neither man was completely familiar with all of the finishing moves. So you get some pauses in the middle of the commentary while, you know, I'm sure they're like scrambling at their notes. Oh, what move was that? That was, you know, such and such. It also, towards the finishing sequence, they kind of stepped over each other a little bit, and it did get a little messy.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I had anything negative to say, it'd be that. For this particular match.
I sometimes, especially when you have a sequence like this, those final 5 minutes, especially Goto hit just about every one of his signature spots. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of specific names to remember. I mean, I think you could just default to the actual description of the move if you have to forfeit, you know, the name that he calls it.
Yeah. I think Moro definitely keeps in mind, you know, the hardcore fan and particularly the person on Twitter who will call him out for not calling a proper move. And I'm sure that's why he makes a point to specifically mention all the proper names, because he himself has a lot of respect for that.
The guy is a perfectionist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because he's one of those fans himself. So, but you're right. I don't think there's a need to specifically call every single thing.
Afterwards, Okada and Gato get into the ring. Okada announces he has no thoughts in particular to share, hands the mic over to Gato, says one more win for Okada to complete his comeback, and that will happen at Invasion Attack, which will be episode 3 against Tanahashi in a rematch for the IWGP title. Tanahashi comes out. Jado says, you've had your appearance, talent Tanahashi, and wants Okada to speak. He says it was a miracle that Tanahashi beat him at the Tokyo Dome earlier that year. Tanahashi says he has not been tired since he was born, and says this will be a battle between love and money, and that love will prevail. And the two pose in the ring, and Tanahashi leaves.
Love versus money.
I love it, dude. The best. Love versus money. So cool. Just picture John Cena cutting this promo on the heel of the day.
It sounds really corny.
Of course it's very corny. There's a segment of fans that hate Tanahashi for this kind of stuff. And the air guitar deal, I mean.
Yeah, but I'll say, you know, without these subtitles, it's very difficult to, I think, gauge, you know, how good somebody is at the promo, of course, if you don't understand it. But with the subtitles, it's really great, and you can, you know, see Okada here saying the words that he's saying with the body language. You can really accurately gauge just how good he is at playing this cocky heel character.
Oh, and it's emphasized even more because they had these sit-downs with Okada, which we finished the episode with, where he's reflecting on the win. He says he raised the level of the New Japan Cup. He won 3 different titles within the span of a year, that being the IWGP title. He won the G1 the prior summer, and now the New Japan Cup. Says he will never enter the New Japan Cup again because he is always a champion. Great.
Mm-hmm. And I love the interviews, too, because they're not like the typical North American look into the camera and shout or even play a character.
Oh, it's the most calm, relaxed, with this like meditation music almost.
It's just like talking normally.
Yeah. I am above any of these tournaments in the future.
Episode 3. This was a case where we did the challenges at the end of the episode to build to the next show.
Yeah.
Better.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This was the Sumo Hall Show Invasion Attack from April 7th, 2013.
Yeah, and they made sure to indicate the dates of the actual events so that, you know, it wasn't like they're portraying them as, you know, live shows or shows that had happened the week prior.
This was the same day as WrestleMania 29.
Pretty good, man.
Yep.
Which was a Sunday.
It was a Sunday. Yeah, that is correct.
Got that one.
Okada again is doing a sit down. He says the fans wanted a change from Tanahashi, and he was the guy to evoke change. Notes how he had lost in January and February of that year to Tanahashi, but then beat Goto in the New Japan Cup final to get this title shot. And Ronaldo runs down the history of both men during their entrances. A very big title match atmosphere here at Sumo Hall. I think at this point in time, they had really established Okada and Tanahashi as kind of the gold standard for pro wrestling feuds at this point in time. They had their initial match in February of 2012. Then they had, that was where they put the title on Okada, which a lot of people criticized at the time how early Okada got the title. He was still off that TNA run and then ended up just exceeding everyone's expectations in 2012. Tanahashi has won two of the three matches at this point. So this was match number four in their series. They would go on to matches at the G1 later that year, the King of Pro Wrestling, and then this prior year's Wrestle Kingdom show in January. So they come out. The crowd is just into everything. From the early portion of the match, Tanahashi does his air guitar motion that Moro says, he can even make the air guitar cool. And Barnett is not co-signing on this observation, saying, I don't know if it's really cool. Moro gets in a comment about Okada's ill-fated trip to TNA as the sidekick of Samoa Joe.
Mm.
Okato.
At one point, he also describes Okada's facials as the Cheshire cat smile on the face of Okada.
Which could have been another gimmick he could have done in TNA. He could have been a cat.
Yeah. Okato.
Why wasn't Okato. I quicker there? Oh. Great stuff early on that would build up throughout the whole match, and that was Tanahashi going after the right arm. Mm-hmm. And immediately the announcers bring up the fact that this is going to weaken Okada later in the match, should he go for the Rainmaker and hurting the arm. And he applied a Kimura in the ropes while they're standing. First big spot of the match was Okada spiking Tanahashi with a DDT on the outside of the apron, and that would allow Okada to get the advantage. He kind of struggled to get this, but locked the arms of Tanahashi and then bridged over his back. Looked cool once he got it, when he finally did. We go through here. Tanahashi blocked a tombstone on the floor and then got to the top, hit the high fly flow to the floor that Barnett noted was... He was struggling for words here and came up with the description, like a flaming bomber, which he immediately questioned what that even was.
Yeah. Yeah, at least he called himself out on it, which is endearing.
I really like this, where Tanahashi was delivering these European uppercuts right into downward elbows onto the bad arm, just continually breaking down this arm. Tanahashi then climbed to the top, gets dropkicked to the floor. It's amazing the height Okada gets on his dropkick. I know it's been said a lot, but he has the most beautiful dropkick in the industry right now. Okada then hits a running boot, draping DDT off the barricade on the floor. He hits the heavy rain in the ring for a near fall. Then Tanahashi blocks the Rainmaker by crossing his arms. The second attempt, Okada hits the Rainmaker, but his arm is in such huge amounts of pain. And right as he's selling this arm, they fade to the shot of the IWGP title.
Mm.
Always great how they do that in the big matches. And then Tanahashi kicks out, and Moro just goes to another gear at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically like, Josh, I got this for the next 10 minutes. And Moro was just this was the most intense I've ever heard Moro.
This is like fucking epic. Like, I don't know if I'd ever seen him or heard.
Like, it was chilling at times.
Yeah.
To be able to call this, to make it sound credible, I mean, I don't think enough people appreciate how difficult it is to call a match of this level with that energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's just say, you know, he's at a level 9 for like most of these high spots. Like, the rest of this match, he was on like level 15. You know, it was crazy.
Tanahashi blocks a tombstone, goes for a roll up. Then Okada gets the red ink, and the referee, Red Shoes, Hiroyuki Uno, was just incredible here, teasing that he was going to call for the bell. Mm-hmm. Moro's yelling, what kind of DNA does each of these athletes possess? and it leads to one of the best rope breaks I've ever seen. It was so dramatic. Tanahashi then attacks the arm again, hits a high fly flow to a standing Okada in the ring, hits a sling blade, dragon suplex. Rinaldo calls, it's just phenomenal. What is going on, Josh? Mm-hmm. And then Tanahashi hits a high fly flow to the back, goes for a second one, but this time Okada gets his knees up. Moro calls this another masterpiece, and they have to take a commercial break.
Sorry.
Breaking Bad reference there.
Another commercial break?
With the bell. Oh. Anyway, I thought just the fact that here you are, the peak of the match, mm-hmm. and you do have to take a commercial break, I mean, that's very tough to have to basically hold off on the energy and then rebuild it.
Right.
And I mean, we weren't watching this with the commercial to break it up. We're just going right to the action continuing.
Going to the top, high fly flow to the
right
back.
Right to the lower spine of
Live
Okada.
Live to see another day, Okada. He's a young wrestler. He's going to have more opportunities. There's not much more he can take.
Here comes Tanahashi off that top rope again. Right onto the knees.
Tanahashi going to the well once too often. Blocking him with the knees.
Tanahashi paying for it. Should have tried to turn him over.
It's another masterpiece. It's going down at Sumo Hall, and it continues here on Access TV. Don't you dare go anywhere.
They come back from the break. Okada gets to his feet, attempts a tombstone, struggles. He can't get it. Tanahashi ducks a rainmaker, lifts Okada for the tombstone. It's reversed. Okada hits the tombstone, picks him up, and hits the rainmaker and gets the win. Just an incredible call.
Yeah.
I believe this is the best Tanahashi-Okada match that they've had, including this past year's Wrestle Kingdom show. 31 minutes, 41 seconds. This is the second time I've watched this episode since it's come out in the past month, and it to me is just an incredible match.
I just felt like everything was perfect here, particularly, you know, I mean the whole match itself, but particularly I'd say the end sequence. Everything, I mean, the two people in the ring are awesome. The referee is awesome, and now you have the commentary to match that level, if not even exceed that level at times. I mean, I thought Moro made this match, had every right to be credited for the success of this viewing as much as the competitors in the ring. I just thought he was able to flow with the match so well. He was able to fit the words in with all the movements perfectly, and the energy level that he expresses at the end is just like, I'd love to watch a video of just him in the booth screaming his head off, you know.
It'd be like watching Pat Barry at cage side when Rose Namajunas fights.
Exactly. So I think it's only appropriate that we give his vocal cords an award. And so I'd like to award the Scott Putski Award for muscular I'm sure he's got very muscular vocal cords.
Okay, so the specification is Moro Ranallo's vocal cords.
Moro Ranallo's vocal cords. Congratulations, you've won the Scott Putski
Award. Wow, that's
a
first.
Yeah.
We should start judging anatomies.
Okay.
Afterwards, this was already, you know, if you put a gun to my head of, you know, one of the best matches I have ever heard called, this one is to me right there. And I'm not even thinking of necessarily other candidates off the top of my head. It was just so well done. Tanahashi is being helped to the back by Captain New Japan and Kushida. He doesn't want to talk. Gato is in the ring, announces history has been changed. Okada's right elbow has an ice pack attached to it, and calls out the boss of Suzuki Army, Minoru Suzuki. Comes out of Suzuki Gun, says that wrestling history has changed, but the industry will always be about him, Suzuki. And then rips up Okada's fake money. Says Okada is weaker than him. Okada is not an invader. He is an invader. Okada makes the rainmaker pose and immediately gets slapped by Suzuki. And then slaps Gato, leaves the ring. Okada says he is about to be a tiny part of the history he is going to create, in referencing Suzuki. And Barnett notes that Okada has a damaged arm, and yet he's challenging this submission artist in Minoru Suzuki to a match, already setting up a storyline, a physical one,
yeah,
for their encounter.
And this was certainly, I mean, I saw this and I realized why, like, people like Dave Meltzer would call it the best, you know, single hour programming that he had ever seen, because not only did you create, you know, get a very good setup and a match itself, a main event that delivered, you had...
Couldn't wait to see this next match.
You had, like, the last 8 minutes of this whole show setting up the next match with another very viable and very entertaining challenger in Minoru Suzuki, who, his delivery, I just love. I mean, I think I've always, you know, heard him and seen him in ring and had appreciated his charisma in ring, but to actually see a translated promo of his, you know, he just reminds me of like Vegeta, to throw in another geeky reference. He reminds me of Vegeta from Dragon Ball Z, who's just like this supremely cocky and confident guy who doesn't show any emotion unless he's being, you know, angry or just maniacally snickering.
Yeah, and then Suzuki goes to the back. He asks what the hell an invader even is, and looks at the camera and tells Okada, "I'll tear your head off. I'll crush it with my hands." Just the exact words you want to come out of the mouth of Minoru Suzuki.
Right.
And then Okada's at the press conference as Gato says that Suzuki can yell all he wants. He won't be able to moan by next month. And they cheers to a pair of Coors Light.
Mm-hmm.
Brock Lesnar's beer.
Coors Light.
And then they go back to the somber music with Okada reflecting on the match, the injury. He said at the end of the match, he couldn't even hear the crowd. It was like fighting in a soundless stage, and winning the title again was going to happen sooner or later. And he talks about his first title win from a year prior, where he says the fans didn't quite know how to react, but now they know, and says Tanahashi is now aware that he cannot beat Okada.
Mm-hmm.
A fantastic 60 minutes of professional wrestling. This episode is so great. I loved it. And if I have to nitpick, it was just the fact how you could put this show together and not include Okada Suzuki in your run of episodes.
They didn't include that.
It's not in it. Hmm. And it's chronologically. So they pass by it and they're not going to go back to it. And I think that's such a lost opportunity because it was so effective. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see this on episode 4. And it's you're not going to get the match, unfortunately.
I'm really curious about how these were originally presented in Japan. Like whether, like if it was a decision from Access, or I would say more likely probably a decision from New Japan themselves to not include these in the original.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like Access dealt with TV Asahi, and TV Asahi are the ones distributing the show worldwide. I don't know if they had a say on what matches are included. There's obviously a lot of emphasis on American stars being featured. There's a lot of Davey Boy Smith throughout these shows. I don't know whose call that is, if that was an Access decision, if it was a TV Asahi idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But it's unfortunate because you watch this show and that is the match you immediately want to see.
Just go to the New Japan World.
You can go. You can go watch it on New Japan World. So there you go. Indirect plug for their streaming service. But two very enjoyable episodes. Episode 3 is at another level. It's probably going to be the best wrestling show you watch all year. And if there's a better one, it's a great year then for wrestling television.
Mm-hmm.
What were your overall thoughts on these two episodes?
I really enjoyed it. And I think, I think for a long time, like, you know, it was cool to be able to know that this guy, you know, had this other talent that so few people knew about. But I think it's great that he now has like a platform to showcase that he can't just do these two other sports, but he actually, in fact, does this third one even better than the other two, in my opinion.
All right, we'll go to the feedback, and we start off with Danny Hernandez. Episode 3 of New Japan on Access was the best hour of wrestling I've ever seen. It was my first time seeing this. Incredible match. Loved the storytelling and presentation. Red Shoes has become my favorite referee in the business. The sell job he did during the STF spot, where he cupped his ear to hear if Tanahashi quit due to the arena being so loud, added to the drama. Enjoyed how the commentary added context to what Okada and Suzuki said during the post-match promo. Not much else to say.
Sorry, I'm looking for the... here we go. Okay, up next, we got Christian Small, who says, I think I'll be joining the many who... Oh, shit, sorry. I just hit the top thing. I think I'll be joining the many who say this show is just awesome. New Japan produces some of the best matches in the world today, and this show perfectly highlights them. From the pre- and post-match segments adding emphasis to the fantastic commentary by Josh Barnett and Moro, I feel that one of the hardest things to do is go back and call an old match as if it's new, but these two do it so well to the point you forget these matches are about 2 years old, and you know the outcome. Really can't say good enough things about this.
Chris writes in from Ottawa, Episode 3 somehow lived up to the incredible hype from Dave Meltzer and others. I wasn't sure how it would, using two-year-old content, but they convey and deliver it so well that it becomes an afterthought. Suzuki's such a terrific heel, great presence, and I've never seen someone get so violently choked in wrestling like Suzuki manhandled Gato since China throttled Marlena at ringside. Who besides Moro and Josh helps out on this show? Are they industry veterans or an in-house access TV team? The latter. This is the best wrestling show on the planet, and they deserve a great deal of praise and recognition for having such a strong presentation from the word go. 11 out of 10, he gives it.
And when you look at it, like, they really don't do anything. There's nothing special. It's not like you have, like, you know, let's say Raw, for instance. They have, like, the production budget to be able to do all these fancy packages, you know, all these fireworks and
you know what's crazy?
Polls and shit like that. There's no need for any of this stuff. You just have good storytelling with some good interviews.
Is it weird that no one had the idea to show Moro and Josh from a different location and announce right at the start that these matches happened 2 years ago, but here we are in Nashville getting ready to call Impact? I mean, I know you're not watching much Impact, but God, the time continuum is just horrible. And they've felt, hey, we're going to present this as if it's happening now, and look at the result of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even though I don't know who the audio technician is.
I haven't been watching
that,
so I can't comment.
I'm sorry about the references, huh?
It's okay. We go to Brad from Whitby, who says, this was my first time watching anything New Japan, and man, was it easy to get into. With respect to Episode 3, I had no idea who either of these guys were before this match, no idea of previous storylines, former feuds, and even who was the heel and who was the face. But with outstanding commentary and superb in-ring storytelling, by the end of the match, I felt so invested in seeing Okada hit his Rainmaker that I marked out when it happened. The in-ring psychology is so simplistic. Tanahashi worked over the arm of Okada so much that he couldn't throw any elbows, lock in the cross-legged STF, and cast serious doubt on him even hitting the Rainmaker. Perfection. I give this episode 2 I give episode 2 7 out of 10. Episode 3 gets 10 out of 10.
Vince from Reedley, California. Hey, John and Wei. Hope you're both having a great day. Well, thank you. New Japan has always had great in-ring, and the great commentary by Moro and Josh is on another level compared to anything else right now. My question is, if this show on Access is New Japan's first run on American TV. On a side note, just wanted to thank John for doing coverage of the 2013 G1. New Japan was on American television. This would be the first time that they've had any kind of regular television In the U.S.,
yeah. I mean, of course, the Fighting Spirit Wrestling, which we carry.
Fighting Spirit Wrestling, yeah. It's, older matches that do air in Canada. Do those air in the U.S. as well?
Aren't they from the U.K.? Originally?
They're from the U.K.
Yeah. Initially. I don't know if they're in the U.S.
So, you would have Fighting Spirit Wrestling out there as well.
Okay, finally, we have Oz from Nottingham, England. Meltzer and Alvarez were not mistaken. Episode 3 is one of the best one-hour shows in wrestling history. The match itself was astonishing with a fairly basic premise that was executed to perfection. I'll echo the sentiments of others. Moro and Josh were tremendous on commentary, giving it the relevance it deserved and treating it like a real sporting event. I guess that's the benefit of not having someone feeding you lines or forcing you to shill a knockouts banner. Josh is worthy of special mention as he played it as a true analyst should, even going so far as to question the tactics of the competitor. 11 Mamma Mias out of 10, which we didn't get any. We don't get
no Mamma Mias.
No more Mamma Mias. What's up? He has a question. He says, what are the benefits and drawbacks of the G1 tournament from a promotion and fan perspective, and would it work in North America?
I mean, it's one of the highlights of the year on the New Japan calendar. I mean, the positives are that you can do some really intricate storytelling throughout the course of a tournament with all the each wrestler can have kind of his own little storyline, and you're basing it all around stats and theoretical matchups later in the tournament. The drawback can be, and we've seen this in the past, is that these guys are going out there to have the best matches in the world with very little time in between matches, and the fallout is that a lot of guys get hurt in these, and I like what they're doing this year where they are spreading this out for this coming summer. It's going to be almost a month to do this tournament, so that guys are going to get more rest in between shows, which I think is a positive and will keep my sanity a bit more.
Yeah, I was going to say, you get a break too.
Yeah, it's a I like doing those shows. I mean, yeah. I like watching all of them, but it's a lot keeping up with it. So I'm not complaining at all that they're going to take a month to do the G1 coming up. And I think it also allows people to follow the tournament a lot easily. Like, not mm-hmm. everybody has 4.5 hours every other day to watch the G1, and you kind of want to be following it as you go and not just picking and choosing and trying to keep up. So, I mean, that in a nutshell, I mean, it's a tournament that last year's tournament, I think, was so well booked, and the way it was laid out, and so many different, you had your A storylines, you had your B, your C level. It was just really well mapped out and had a lot of repercussions, both that they had set up initially to pay off in the G1 and coming out of the G1. So, and yeah, I think anything that is successful in one area of the world can work other places. It's just keeping your ideas open that something outside of your promotion can work.
Yeah, I think, you know, it seems like it's a very detailed thing to book, something as complicated as that. And we've seen, you know, North American companies like TNA try their versions of it and to mix results. You know, it sounds like it's something that requires a lot of intricate details.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the booking of last year's G1 and compare it to any year of the Bound for Glory series. I mean, the idea is there, but the execution is sometimes very different from what you're trying to achieve. So that is going to wrap up this week's edition of Review Away. Very fun show to go back and watch those two episodes. Way, you have a selection for next week's review.
Well, we've been watching the free preview of the WWE Network here at the office. We've just been having it on. We just had it on that main TV in the lobby pretty much all month. And
yeah, we had Roddy Piper celebrating Black History Month.
That's right. I was shocked. I was just astonished. And but, you know, something I've noticed, I've never sat down to watch the network proper other than, you know, the on-demand stuff. I've never really watched the live stream. But, you know, we always have, like, the TV on here. So one channel is, you know, usually MMA, but one channel now is taken up by the network, and the network people always stop and look at it. Like, when it's just like, you know, the live stream, which we get in Canada, people just always stop and watch it. And there's just something about wrestling that's just so colorful with such a rich history that, you know, it's always interesting. So I actually really like the network when just in this format, just as, you know, walking around and having it on and seeing, you know, what's available. And what caught my eye recently was an episode of Clash of the Champions.
Yes.
And this, of course, featured a confrontation between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat.
I've heard of those two.
And, you know, our colleague Corey Erdman here, who's also a big wrestling fan, you know, was just talking about it and talking about this as the build-up to their infamous match at
the Chi-Town Rumble.
The Chi-Town Rumble, which I had never seen before. So I'd like to watch that.
Chi?
We should consult.
Maybe both are.
Yes? What is this website?
How to pronounce. Chi?
What was that website you went to before, the pronunciation website?
That's where I'm going. Oh, look at this. The first thing is Chi-Town pronounced Chi or She-Town? Chi-Town. Chi-Town?
Well, Chi, because it's Chicago.
She-Town.
So is it She-Town or
they're saying Chi-Town. The Chi-Town Rumble.
Gotcha.
The Chi-Town Rumble.
Chi-Town.
We're going to talk about
Chinatown.
We're going to talk about dip and chives next week.
Okay.
Okay. The Chi-Town Rumble.
Chi-Town Rumble. Yes, featuring Ricky Steamboat versus Ric Flair. And that is, of course, available on the WWE Network.
Yeah. Spoiler. It's a good match.
Oh, I hope so.
Yes. Way said, I want to review this. I want to see these Flair Steamboat matches.
Yeah.
So there were three big matches in 89, so maybe we can work our way through them over the year.
Yeah.
Sure. But we'll start off with the Chi-Town Rumble next week, Flair Steamboat in Chicago, UIC Pavilion. Get ready. It's on the network, so you can check that out. And What else? Oh, I also do want to make mention for those that have been inquiring and maybe not heard our news yet. I'm going to bombard people with this over the next month and a half. We do have our live edition of Review Away coming up Sunday, March 29th, WrestleMania weekend at the Smoking Pig Barbecue in San Jose, California. It's going to happen 11 a.m. Pacific time, Sunday, March 29th. We have a Facebook group up, which I've been meaning I will post up on the message board so everyone can find it. We've already got close to 40 people confirmed, Way. I'm a little concerned that we're going to go over our estimate.
I feel like we should stop promoting it.
Yeah, maybe we should pull back a little.
Yeah, so a few people. I don't know how many people this place can hold.
They'll make room. These people seem very accommodating to us. So we'll be doing the live podcast that day. You can show up. You can meet Way or Y, whichever you prefer.
I'll answer to both.
Yes. I will sign Way's name for him if you so choose to get his autograph, and he's busy.
And I will sign John Polak.
Polak. And then the podcast we'll put up later that week. We'll do kind of a look back. This will be the day after the Hall of Fame, so who knows what we'll be chatting about. Mm-hmm. Maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to have a great speech about his mother.
Maybe more stories from John's early dating life as a young 12-year-old.
Maybe we'll bring a VHS tape and play it.
Mm.
Smart ask.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if VHS is – I don't know if the VCR is anymore down in San Jose.
All right. Don't we have to go to a – audio and video outlets? I'm sure they could help us.
I don't know about that.
I think we should. Is this VHS tape at your parents' house?
I don't have to give you any more details.
I'm gonna call up your dad. I'm gonna find out.
Good luck.
Your dad should join us. Is he interested in coming down to San Jose?
He'd love to.
That'd be a lot of fun.
He'll be busy. He will be working.
He could be our roving reporter in the audience, taking questions.
No. Why don't we get your
my dad?
Yeah. No, actually, your parents are cool. Like, they won't be funny. They will be funny. Yes, don't get me wrong. But, like, they will be they won't be as, like, funny as, say, your ex-girlfriend's mother who freaked out and called your parents.
Yeah, I don't think
have you been in touch? Do you know what she is up to, your former girlfriend from age 12?
Not really. Not sure.
What's her name? Look her up right now.
Yeah, you have learned that lesson about we don't give out names of anybody
right,
on the show.
Well, just look her up on Facebook.
I
why not? Just do it. Just out of curiosity, as a way to close the podcast.
No, we're not going to do that.
Why not? You don't have to mention her name.
I'm metaphorically slamming the door on this conversation. So we're going to get on out of here. We're going to call up Wing, and we're going to chat about him possibly coming down to San Jose.
Sure.
It'll be a lot of fun. What should we end this show off with? Something fun.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? We have to go out with the Putski Award winner.
Sure.
One more call just to end off this New Japan on Access show.
Mm.
Good night.
Sling Blade! Sling Blade!
Dragon Suplex!
Suplex with the bridge!